ACDLA versus Lamont case. I believe everyone has joined, but I'm going to ask counsel, starting with plaintiff's counsel, to identify themselves for the record.
Good morning, Your Honor. This is Dan Barrett from the Ethereum Foundation. Can I have a statement?
All right, and what I think I'm going to do, since there's quite a few, I'll just sort of do a roll call, okay? So, Attorney Gohara?
I'm here, Your Honor, thank you.
Attorney Orihela?
I'm here, Your Honor, thank you.
Attorney Metcalf?
Good morning, Your Honor, thank you.
Attorney Bildner?
Good morning, Your Honor, I'm here.
Attorney Rosen?
Good morning, Your Honor, I'm here.
Attorney O'Neill?
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm here.
Attorney Strom?
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm here as well.
Attorney Belforti?
Attorney
Belforti? Good morning, Your Honor. I'm here.
And Attorney Donahue?
Good
morning, Your Honor. Here.
All right, and I'm going to ask everyone to make sure that their phones are on mute unless they're speaking, and I'm going to do the same when I'm done going through the housekeeping. And I understand Lisa Backus, a member of the media, is also listening to the call, and that counsel had no objection to that. So I know that counsel spoke with Attorney Ferraro, and the proposal that counsel came up with was that the defendants as move-ins would argue for 20 minutes. The plaintiffs would then have 30 minutes, and then the move-ins, the defendants, would have 10 minutes in rebuttal. And I anticipated, unless you didn't want it, just to have Attorney Ferraro give sort of a two-minute warning near the end of your time. If that does not work for anyone, can you just let me know now? Otherwise, I'll keep going on. Okay? Before we start the argument, can I just inquire, does anyone have any other housekeeping matters or issues before we start arguing? Okay, no news is good news. I did see that there was an application in the file of proposed amicus, and I am going to deny that, so the record will reflect that. And hearing nothing from anyone else at this point, we'll start with who's going to argue, if I might ask, for the defense, and who is going to argue for the plaintiffs.
Moyer, this is James Belforti with the Attorney General's Office. I'll be arguing for the defense today.
Alrighty.
Your Honor, this is Dan Barrett.
All right. Thank you very much. Attorney Belforti, whenever you're ready. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, good morning to everyone. Today, the plaintiffs are asking this court to issue a mandamus ordering the governor and the commissioner of corrections to immediately release thousands of prisoners en masse, and for this court to supervise and execute a plan involving the minutiae and intricacies of prison administration, of housing, of sanitation, and of health care. For a variety of reasons, this court lacks subject matter jurisdiction. First issue I want to talk about is standing, particularly with regards to plaintiff CCDLA. CCDLA lacks standing here because they make no allegations of injury in the amended complaint. There are only four paragraphs that actually touch on CCDLA at all. And it's just generally alleged that CCDLA is a non-profit organization that is comprised of criminal defense lawyers, that they have a membership of about 300 members, that they have certain clients who are held in DOC facilities, and that they engage in education and advocacy for the fair treatment of those accused of crimes. So ultimately, they don't establish any direct injury in their own right. And for that reason, they lack any classical agreement. They also lack third-party standing or any associational standing, because a requirement of both of those tests, the first requirement, is that they have an injury in their own right. And because there's just nothing alleged in the amended complaint addressing anything to do with how the membership of the CCDLA injured, they cannot avail themselves of
any kind of third-party standing, and they cannot avail themselves of any kind of associational standing. This case is similar in that regard to the Juvenile Trial Lawyers Association case that came out of the District of Connecticut, the federal court case, because here there's an extra layer between TCPLA and the actual inmate. They're the attorneys instead. This isn't an organization of inmates who are seeking a redress of any kind of wrongs. This is an organization of criminal defense attorneys who happen to have certain of their members who have clients who happen to be in prison. But they don't make any allegation as to how anything that the defendants have actually done has in any way harmed them. And to the extent they make that allegation in their opposition to our papers, that would be an attempt to amend their complaint in their opposition, which they can't do. And also, it's particularly problematic here because they've already amended their complaint with our consent once that we did in an effort to try to move this along because we understand the exigencies of these circumstances. So to the extent they rely on any kind of argument about, you know, exposure to risk of infection, that just was not in the pleading. And because we're a fact-pleading state, that's what's ultimately fatal to their claim. Moving on to the issue of the actual individual plaintiffs here, the individual inmate plaintiffs, they also lack standing here because they have no legal interest in being released early from prison. And because they lack that legal interest, they don't pass the first portion of the classical agreement test. And that's what's crucial here, because what they're asking for, the remedy in this case is actually very important, because what they're asking for isn't just a recognition of some failure on the part of the defendants to meet a standard or to meet a constitutional minimum. What they're asking for is early release from prison, and they don't have a right to that. Because they don't have a right to that, they cannot be injured by the defendants essentially exercising their discretion not to release them early from prison. Otherwise, any inmate could essentially have standing and get by the standing requirements. It's also important to recognize that it does not appear from the amended complaint that there's any distinction between the relief requested on behalf of CCPLA or the relief requested on behalf of the individual plaintiffs. So it can't necessarily be assumed that all of the relief that would inure to the benefit of the non-party inmate is being asked on behalf of CCPLA. So for that same reason, the individual plaintiffs don't have third-party standing here as well. They don't have any ability to assert the rights of inmates with whom they have no relationship and with whom they may have never even met. So even if they had an injury in their own right, which they don't, they would still fail any kind of third-party standing test because they don't have a close relationship and they don't have any kind of hindrance being heard because we have inmates before this court right now. In terms of hindrance, I would just point out that we are before the court today presumably because this is captioned as an emergency motion, not because it's a mandamus. Because as alleged in the complaint, mandamus is not a priority one business matter either. So the fact that we're before this court is simply because they're seeking emergency relief, and there's nothing to suggest that the inmates in this case or anyone else could seek an emergency writ of habeas corpus or some sort of emergency bond reduction or anything like that. So even that is another reason why neither of these parties have third-party standing. And I would also point out with regard to, the associational standing, on behalf of CCDLA, the germaneness issue jumps out as well because the actual stated mission, as stated in the amended complaint, is about representing people accused of crimes and advocating within a criminal context. It's not about representing people in conditions of confinement cases. And there's a pretty important distinction between those two. There's no Sixth Amendment right to have somebody file a civil complaint on your behalf in a conditions of confinement case. So there's no argument that in any way they're being interfered with, that there's any injury in that respect. And there's no argument that a Criminal Defense Lawyers Association has germane to the issue of conditions of confinement.
You can move on, Ken.
You can move on, Ken.
Oh, thank you. So with regard to political question, I just want to make a few points. What the plaintiffs are asking here is for this court, via mandamus, to order executive officials to exercise their discretion, which was granted to them by the legislature in a certain fashion. So right off the bat, this cries out for separation of powers concern. And I would also point out that the remedy requested here is important to consider as well, because as the Supreme Court recognized in the Connecticut Coalition for Justice v. Rell case, the remedy and the right are important within the context of political question. They cite to the Seymour v. Region 1 Board of Education case, and in both of these cases, the reason the court was able to find that there were not political questions presented and that the court was capable of making these determinations is because the alternative relief sought by the plaintiffs in those cases was simply a declaration that something the defendants had done did not meet a standard or was unconstitutional. But that's not what the plaintiffs are asking for here. There is no such alternative relief within the complaint. What they're asking for here is specific action. They're saying they want these inmates released. They want them released via these statutes because they reference transitional supervision, home confinement. They reference Connecticut General Statute 18-100H. They reference all of these individual statutory provisions that confer discretion on the executive officials involved, the defendants involved in this case. And because that is what they are asking for, and they are not simply asking this court to issue a declaration that what the defendants are doing is unconstitutional or what they're doing does not meet some sort of statutory requirement, that's what causes the real political question issue to come to the fore here. And I think that's what really distinguishes this case from the Coalition case and from the Seymour Ward 1 case. In those cases, the court really focused on the fact that the remedy could be, and I'm quoting now, with the precise remedy being left to the defendants in the first instance. If the court were to grant this mandamus in the way it's structured within this amended complaint, there would be no wiggle room like that. There would be no ability for the executives to come in and fix whatever problems they're complaining of. It would simply be, you have to do this. You have to exercise your discretion in this way. And that's not saved by the fact that they are also asking for a plan to be submitted to the court with the court's, I guess, monitoring, supervision, and execution, because the things they're asking for within that plan are all policy determinations and discretionary choices that jump off the page. So we look at some of the plans they're asking for. They use words like they want adequate sanitation and social distancing in prison so as to prevent the spread of COVID-19. So that kind of begs the question, well, who makes that determination? Presumably, in this case, it would be the plaintiffs as enforced by this court. But that's not how it went in the Coalition case, and that's not how it went in the Seymour case. In those cases, what saved it from the political question doctrine was the fact that they were simply asking the court to render a decision that what they were doing was not good enough. And that was something that really made a difference here. They're also asking for a plan about diagnosing and treating people in accordance with the contemporary standards of care. Again, that begs the question, according to who? Who determines that? We also see within the first portion of the request for relief, they want a number of inmates to be released to a, quote, appropriate medical facility where necessary. So again, those ask the question of who decides what is appropriate, who decides where necessary. They want this court to, quote, meaningfully reduce the population density at each and every facility. Again, what does it mean to be meaningful? All of these questions are things that are policy determinations that are made in the first instance by executive officials. And they're particularly acute in this context, both because they're seeking a mandamus, which cannot lie where there's any kind of discretion, and because they're seeking it against the Commissioner of Correction, a prison official. And every court that has considered this, including and especially our Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court, has recognized that correctional officials are owed deference in how they manage prisons and in how they respond crises such as COVID-19. In this case, what the plaintiffs are asking from this court is to basically have this court act as a super commissioner or a super prison official to get down into the granularity of how many people are presumably housed in a block, how often are they cleaning the cells, three times a day, four times a day, how much of a distance must they keep, are they housed together, how often do they have to see the doctor. Is the doctor okay? Does it have to be a nurse practitioner? And it goes on and on and on. And these are exactly the kinds of non-judicial functions that the court was so concerned about in both the Seymour case and in the Coalition for Justice case. That was something that the court specifically said in that case, and I'm quoting, or I'm referencing Seymour now, which is also quoted in the Coalition for Justice case, that the court had grave concerns if the relief sought was just setting up a new taxing district. The court would have grave concerns about the justiciability there. But because of the alternative relief sought, that's what saved it from the political question doctrine. Here we don't have that alternative relief sought. So just as it was the case with standing, we also have the issue where what is in the complaint, they are bound by that. So the fact that they haven't sought an alternative relief really is problematic. I'd also point out that political question is taken on a case-by-case basis, and I think the fact and circumstances here are even more acute for political question because this goes beyond simply disrespecting one political branch. This is disrespecting both political branches because they are seeking to use the statutory scheme set up by the legislature that imbues discretion throughout and is given to executive officials. They're seeking to use that via mandamus to have the courts order executive officials what to do. So it wouldn't just be disrespecting the executive officials. It would be disrespecting the legislature as well. And it would be particularly problematic here when it's in the context of prison officials. I'd also like to point out that when they're asking for this mass release of inmates, it just compromises judicial comity as well, because we're talking about every single inmate who's in the facility is there because of some order from a court, whether it be a judgment minimis or a bond decision or something like that. So this court would essentially have to take all of those orders and get rid of them in order to give the relief that they want. So that causes concerns as well. And, Your Honor, if there are no questions about the political question doctrine, I'll sum up with some thoughts on cyber immunity.
Very well.
Thank you, Your Honor. So just real quick on sovereign immunity and the 11th Amendment, I'd just like to make a couple of quick points. What they're asking for here, although it appears or it's couched in terms of prospective relief, really would be a recognition of past harm and compensation for that past harm. Because what they're essentially saying here is that these inmates should have been let out early. They were not let out early. And now because of that, we have to fund transitional housing, we have to fund all of these different things. Essentially, it would be an order of this court to the governor and to the commissioner to write a check to fund a number of things that wouldn't ordinarily be funded by executive officials. And it's because of supposed failures that have already taken place to do that. That's just a request for money damages. And in this case, the state has not consented to it. And it would also run, and so therefore, it would run afoul of sovereign immunity. But also run afoul of the 11th Amendment. If there's also a problem here based on this suggested plan on behalf of the plaintiffs, because that begs the question, what if the funding is later determined by this court to be inadequate or later argued to be inadequate? Then essentially what's happening is the court is asked to make a determination that the defendants are not meeting their obligations and then to issue money from the public fund in order to make up for that. Again, that sounds in money damages. And that's why it violates both concepts of sovereign immunity and the 11th Amendment. So, Your Honor, at this point, unless there are any questions, I don't have any further points, and I rest on our briefing.
Thank you, counsel.
Attorney Barrett, whenever you're ready, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. The plaintiff comes to this court asking to get approximately 13,000 people out of the way of a pandemic that has changed effectively every part of the globe, except for about 14 state buildings full of human beings living in proximity that the defendants admit in every other context. take care of the people he keeps under lock and key during a civil and health emergency, both of which have been declared in the face of COVID-19. There are seven plaintiffs in this case. Six of them are behind bars, and they have brought to the court stripped forward and incredibly detailed Eighth Amendment claims having to do with the conditions in prison. These are not allegations that the plaintiffs suffered some sort of injury in the past that are now here in front of the court with their hands out. These are incredibly detailed allegations. I would venture to say far more detailed than those that the court usually sees in case of any context, detailing how the conditions within the prison fail to meet contemporary standards and therefore violate both the Eighth Amendment and the governor's statutory duty to take care of those he keeps under lock. The prisoners themselves unquestionably have standing to raise these claims. Now, the defendants shoehorn a number of arguments that are really posed towards the merits of their Eighth Amendment claims as if they are jurisdictional, but they're not. And although the defendants very much wish to focus the court on the relief, the court here is sitting in equity, and it has the ability to fashion an equitable relief based on the facts it finds and the court's wisdom as applied to the facts that are in front. So the plaintiffs don't wish for the court to lose sight of the fact that their claims here are quite straightforward, and these, it would be difficult to find individual plaintiffs that are better situated to raise these claims. They are directly affected by each and every one of them. Now, as to the individual plaintiffs, of course, these people are under lock and key. They are being held in close confinement with other people in situations that at least Governor Lamont has conceded in every other context highly dangerous and leads to the spread of the COVID-19 pathogen. The CCDLA is a group of criminal defense lawyers who represent those very people. And they have a number of difficulties when it comes to representing their clients in the face of the pandemic. The court, of course, can take notice of its own orders, which have reduced the court's operations down to bare bones. But in criminal proceedings these days, there are still in-person appearances. So, for example, CCDLA members are both at risk of infection from their clients who have been held by the defendants and are also risking infecting their clients during those appearances. The CCDLA's interests are, of course, incredibly germane to this case because their job is not simply to show up on court dates and try to get their client off from whatever criminal charges are in front of them. They are their clients have concerns over conditions and a variety of other moving parts that go into criminal representation. CCDLA members, like lawyers everywhere else, represent the whole client. So there are habeas concerns, there are condition concerns that they represent them on, there are bond modifications. There's every array of instances in which CCDLA members must attend to the needs of the clients who happen to be behind bars. Now, every plaintiff who brings the action in front of this court is, in a sense, seeking in one way through the mandamus remedy to vindicate a collective right to avoid the pandemic disaster. And so, although the defendants are very focused on one possible avenue of relief, which is the release of any one plaintiff, what the plaintiffs are asking for is a range of things that may include release, because as a matter of necessity, as the defendants have conceded in every other aspect of daily life in Connecticut today, there is a distancing and a sanitation requirement that has to be met. And so you can't quite look at this case as each person vindicating solely their own right to effectively be at a distance from other people. That has to be done in mass. So it wouldn't be possible to just say, well, this one plaintiff, he gets to be moved somewhere else, everyone else stays put. In order for the system to work, and in order for the prison system to granularize, if you will, and contain the pathogen, everyone has to be subject to the same conditions, that is, minimum sanitation, medical care, and distancing and personal protection. So it's far too narrow to look at this as a number of individuals who are simply coming to court And the reason why is that the defendants have issued their own declaration about the dangers of COVID-19, affecting virtually every corner of Connecticut, while steadfastly refusing to do the same for prison. And at the speed at which the pathway is moving, we are far past the point of simply calling the defendants into court and pointing out to them that there is a pandemic. They already know there is. They've already taken measures reaching down to the direction in which we shop in the food store. But they've refused to do that in prison. So declaratory relief is not what's needed here. What's needed here is the firm hand of the court enforcing the Constitution and the general statutes. In effect, MedEnz is built for this precise situation because what we have is a branch of government that refuses to adhere to the Constitution, and it needs a direct demand to do that. We really think that the political question, sovereign immunity arguments, are overly focused on one particular form of relief, and they're also inapposite. I mean, if you take the defendant's argument about political question to their logical conclusion, it's difficult for me to understand what situation would exist in any factual configuration that the court could issue a directive to the Department of Correction or any state official to stop ignoring the Constitution. The court's function is say what the law is, and to ensure that the other branches adhere to it. This is particularly important with respect to the Constitution because both of the elected branches don't have any particular incentive to adhere to the Constitution, particularly when it comes to a disfavored numerical minority such as those behind bars. The sovereign immunity argument is the same. I think what you're seeing, Your Honor, is an argument on one hand which places political questions and sovereign immunity arguments side by side. The other defendant saying, effectively, we don't know, and the court can't make us do anything but pay money damages. That's all the court is able to tell us that we would understand. Otherwise, it would require a great level of detail and meddling. But then, on the other hand, the court definitely cannot issue an award of damages because of sovereign immunity. You know, neither is true. The court very well can direct the defendants to do things that happen to have an incidental cost of money. That's the cost of complying with the Constitution. It would be impossible to imagine a case in which the court remedies a prison condition that didn't require some expenditure of money, no matter how small, whether it be overtime or additional staff or things like that. So the two of them seem to be very much a red herring. The merits of the Eighth Amendment claims are also remarkable when it comes to the defendant's position. To win on the merits, and again, these are really merits arguments that they're shoehorning into a subject matter jurisdiction context, but to win on them, the court is well aware that the defendants must prove that an infection with COVID-19 is not a serious medical condition, even though Defendant Lamont has acknowledged that in every other context. And in fact, begins his first executive order, that's number 7, by saying that there's a pandemic, it's in Connecticut, COVID-19 is a respiratory disease spreading easily from person to person, and that it may result in serious illness and death. So good luck to them on that. And or they must also prove that they were not actually aware of the risk that COVID-19 poses to humans, which again is belied by the extreme measures imposed upon every other aspect of daily life in Connecticut. Just as we, a group of lawyers, are not in front of the court today. We are here by telephone because of the danger posed by in-person contact, even in situations that are far more remote than the plaintiff's living conditions. So you are I feel like I've engaged in the cardinal sin of lawyers, which is to talk perhaps too much. And so what I would like to do is ask the court if I can address anything in specific.
You can just continue your argument if you'd
like. I don't have any specific questions.
Very good. Well, then I think I'll rest on her papers.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, Counsel Attorney Goff-Lurkey.
Yes, Your Honor. I'll just try to briefly reply. So, plaintiff makes this claim a couple times that we're focused too much on the relief, and we're focused too much on the remedy. And the reason we're focused on the remedy is because that's what the Supreme Court focuses on in regards to a political question issue. And that's what the court focused on in the Coalition case, and that's what the court focused on in the Seymour case. They looked at what they were actually asking for and decided whether or not the court was in the position to exercise a judicial function to give that relief. They found that determining whether or not certain standards have been met is a judicial function, but telling executive officials, managing for legislative officials, how to meet certain standards was not a judicial function. And that's what jumps out in this case, because again, as the plaintiff's counsel just said, we are not in declaratory relief land anymore. We are in mandamus, and therein lies the problem, because mandamus is all about a lack of discretion. And here, the legislature has given executive officials all kinds of discretion when it comes to whether and under what circumstances to release certain inmates. And in this case, the executive officials have been exercising that discretion. What the plaintiffs are trying to do is to come in and have the court say, you're not exercising that discretion in the way we would like you to, or you're not doing it quickly enough, or you're not doing it broadly enough. And the problem is, again, as the plaintiff's counsel said, this complaint is, this only works en masse. We have to do this en masse, which again eviscerates the discretion that has been given to these executive officials to make these determinations on a case-by-case basis. And with regards to the Eighth Amendment claim, I would just point out a couple of quick things. First of all, whether or not the inmates have an Eighth Amendment claim in the first right is important for whether or not CCDLA has any kind of third-party standing. Because if the party upon whom you are asserting rights does not have a claim in the first instance, you cannot exercise third-party standing. And I take slight issue with what plaintiff's counsel described as, basically, we have to say that COVID-19 is not a serious medical condition or something like that. I don't think that that's the case, and I don't think that's the argument that we put forward. It's that you have to show a mental element that is more than mere negligence. And in this case, what the plaintiffs are basically alleging is, well, yeah, you've taken certain actions, and those actions are commendable, but they're not good enough. And those are negligence arguments. And that just does not lie here. You can't have an Eighth Amendment claim based on an allegation that people aren't doing enough. And again, it all comes down to that same issue, which is you're not exercising the discretion in the way we would like you to. So just in closing, I'd just like to make one more point, which is, you know, ultimately the defendants recognize the seriousness of the COVID-19 crisis. No one takes the health and well-being of Connecticut citizens more seriously than the defendants in this case. And that includes the DOC staff and obviously the inmate population. But importantly, it also includes all of the 3 million plus citizens of Connecticut. What the plaintiffs are seeking is the mass release of thousands of inmates. I mean, I think plaintiffs count up to 13,000 inmates into a community that is fighting this pandemic. And they're seeking this mass release without any supervision, without any consideration of whether these inmates are suited for early release, whether they will have a safe home environment, whether they will have any access to medical or mental health care. They're also seeking the immediate mass relocation of thousands of inmates to medical facilities without regard to whether these inmates actually have any symptoms related to COVID-19 at a time when the state and the whole world is trying desperately to ensure that we have the space and the personnel and the equipment to treat all of our citizens, including inmates, including everybody. In short, what the plaintiffs are seeking is not just illegal and bordering on unconstitutional with separation of powers concerns, but it's facile and it's potentially dangerous. It's reckless. This is why the exercise of discretion by seasoned experts and by executive officials is so crucial in situations like these, why it's done on an individualized basis. And this is why the legislature set up the system the way that it did. This court, therefore, lacks subject matter jurisdiction and must dismiss this case. Thank you, Your Honor. That concludes my argument.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you, counsel.
So I appreciate the argument today, and I did neglect to say at the outset that I'm very grateful to both sides for the extensive and thorough briefs, especially given that they were filed on such abbreviated deadlines. So I am grateful for that, and I do have my work cut out for me. What I am intending to do is to issue a decision this month. It's April 15th today, so I'm going to shoot for next week, but I'm intending to get it filed this month. Whether it's going to be a granted, denied decision to follow, or whether I'm able to actually get the decision done in writing April, we'll let you know about that. And then the other thing we will do is we will make sure that the branch makes the FTR, the audio, available, because I know both sides were interested in that as well. So we'll follow through and make sure that that's available. Does either side have anything else for today? No? Okay, thank you very much. Take care.
Take care.
We're off the record. We're adjourned.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.